Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to All Stats On, we're a podcast in which Leeds fans cast their combined eye over goings-on at Elland Road, giving scrutiny to the underlying statistics and tactical footings at work at Leeds United. I'm John McKenzie, the first Bamford goal of the podcast. Take that, Gabby Abbon-Lahore. And I'm joined by the second Bamford goal of the podcast, Tom Woodhead. Pick that one out of the net, Gabby. And finally, the Gabby Abbon-Lahore Twitter account of the podcast, strangely missing at the most important times. It's Joe Hill. Joe, how are you?
I'm great. You love to see it. You love to see some good old-fashioned Twitter banter. It was just something brilliant to wake up to this morning and just take a good scroll. And I think the Leeds fans as a collective did a fantastic job of shutting him down, which is brilliant.
Tom Woodhead, how are you?
Yeah, I'm great. The word Gabby, the more you say it, the more you realise that it is the name of a middle-aged woman. Yeah, I'm great. Yeah, that was super fun last night, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think it made a difference it being a Friday night, weirdly. It was quite nice just sort of being the first game up, knowing that everyone was watching us, getting it sort of out of the way early on so you can kind of not worry about it for the rest of the weekend. And yeah, and winning it in the way that we did was the cherry on top, really. Joe, you must have enjoyed that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of my favourite feelings is playing first and winning comfortably. And then you can just sit back, watch all the other fixtures and just sort of not really care what happens. You know, I'm just sort of looking back at all the goals and looking at all the reaction and just seeing other people play and just having a great weekend, really. I think it's a fantastic start. And it definitely silenced a lot of the haters who were slagging off Leeds this week.
I think it made a big difference it coming at the end of the week that it came as well, like with all the, you know, the awful stuff that the government's doing regarding child meals and football actually for once being a positive force for social change. And then, you know, so the whole week's been quite intense in that regard, I found anyway. And then you get to Friday night and you're just hoping to all hell that we don't fuck it up and ruin the weekend. And when you actually come through that and you know, play as well as we did, it's a great feeling. And it's rare, so we need to savor it.
Yeah, and lovely to see Liam Cooper in the Leeds squad getting behind the backing of food banks in Leeds as well.
Absolutely.
Thank you to anyone who off the back of our tweet about giving the money for the pay-per-view this Friday to the Leeds food bank. And yeah, it's great seeing that fans can come together collectively and make that sort of difference. So all in all, a really positive weekend for us. Let's talk about the game in particular. I've just seen Tom Woodhead take a massive swig of his Brewdog, so I'm going to ask him the question first. Obviously, other beers are available. We should get a sponsorship from a beer company, shouldn't we?
That's the most like podcast thing you can ever say, isn't it? Like, other things are available.
Yeah, exactly.
People always say that on podcasts.
As if anyone cares. Yeah. This Brewdog are going to ring us and be like, oh, excuse me, I listened to your podcast the other week and you mentioned our beer, but no one else's.
To be fair, Brewdog once did issue a lawsuit against one of my friends and asking him to change the name of his artistic, like, his songwriting output. So, you know, maybe they would.
This is a band, Drew Bog. is it? But yeah, Tom, let's talk about the game itself. It's been, I want to say it's been more than 12 hours, but yeah, it has. It's not been quite 24 hours. We've got a bit of critical distance from the game. How are you looking back on that game, and how do you see it now with the cold, hard light of the next day at your disposal?
Yeah, I haven't had the opportunity to watch the entire thing back, although I did watch the first 20 minutes or so, because I was quite, at the time it felt to me like Stroik was actually playing okay, apart from his, apart from, you know, a couple of rash challenges that could have seen him taken off. And yeah, in general, I just thought we played very, very well. It wasn't perfect, and it never is, but this felt like one of those championship games where we, as opposed to the Wolves game that felt like, you know, Wigan, this felt more like one of those championship games where we just seem like we're first to every loose ball. And every time Villa had a touch, they seem really panicked because they haven't had the ball for ages, and they're making bad decisions because we're forcing them in, you know, to make bad decisions all the time from the amount of pressure that we're putting on. So it definitely felt like probably the most complete performance of the season so far.
How about you, Joe? How are you looking back on that game?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with Tom. It was a complete performance. I mean, you know, not 100%. There was that spell before half time where it felt like Villa were growing into the game. But overall, yeah, I think it was fantastic performance, fantastic away from home. I think we just did all the right things. Like, every player seemed to step up, as particularly the ones that were out of position. So I'm thinking of Ayling, Click. They stepped up for me big time. I thought they were men of the match, and obviously Bamford getting a hat trick, you know, that deserves some credit, because the second and third finish were amazing. But I think this was really about the players stepping up that had been moved out of position.
Yeah, for sure. Right, let's just talk about quickly the first half, and then a bit about the second half as well. Just do the overview stuff. The first half, watching it back, I was, I guess, not interested in how much I thought Villa had chances in that first half. I didn't come away from the game thinking as though we absolutely deserved to win off the basis of the first half performance in particular. But it was interesting watching it back, and, you know, we talk about game state a lot on here, and Villa had a few chances where they could have maybe changed things around a little bit. So let's talk a bit about the first half in particular, because the game felt a lot more balanced in the first half, didn't it, Joe?
Yeah, it did. And I think Villa were doing a good job of sort of making it quite bitty. I think they were going down for fouls quite a bit and slowing the pace of it down, and, you know, just doing what we all thought they might do to keep a lid on the pace of the game. And then, like you say, the game state obviously changed that in the second half. But yeah, the first 20 minutes, I thought we were fantastic. First maybe 25, we seemed to be dominating possession of the ball, and then Villa just sort of grew into it before half time, and it was looking like it was going to be one of those games where if Villa nicked the first goal, I think it would have been really, really difficult. And actually, Melier made some brilliant saves to keep us in the game at that point, so that deserves a lot of credit too.
Yeah, there was a couple of chances, wasn't there? Obviously, there was the Grealish chance that was cleared off the line by Ayling, and then there was a, I think as well in the first half, that Stuart Dallas inexplicable ball across the field, which I think was that to Grealish as well, and then Ayling pulled off a great challenge. It may have been Watkins, I can't remember who it was in particular, but there was a few things there. And obviously then you had the Jack Grealish run and chance at the beginning of the second half as well, but then after that it was all plain sailing. Tom, what are your thoughts on Villa's sort of threatening chances, and how different could the game have been had one of those come off?
Yeah, obviously it's always going to be really difficult for us as soon as we go a goal behind, because teams can just sit off then and play on the counter. It did feel like the chances that Villa created, it was mostly via individual skill, or, you know, moments of individual creativity, mostly from Grealish. So it definitely didn't feel like they were carving us open in a particularly tactical way where we were exposing our flaws or anything like that, which is, it always makes me feel a bit more sanguine about the chances when it's like that. You know, Grealish is a great dribbler, so if Grealish dribbles through half your team, then, you know, what you're going to do? You can't put two men on him because that messes up our entire plan. So I think you have to accept that those sort of chances are just part and parcel of the way we play. And I, from memory, I don't think there were any chances where I thought, oh, Jesus Christ, that's bad defending or anything like that, apart from potentially the one that Ayling cleared off the line, which was caused by Ayling. I think Ayling's got a bit of a crisis of confidence regarding his flop now because it's not been working as well in the Premier League. No, genuinely, like in the Championship, he would have flopped there 100%, but it feels like it's not fooling the refs so much in the Premier League. So he, you know, he dithered on the ball a bit and it got nicked for him, but obviously did fantastically well to get back on the line.
I've got a couple of things to say, actually. One is that something that people haven't really remarked on is the way that Luke Ayling was playing at left centre-back. And I wondered whether or not anyone had any thoughts on that. My initial feeling was that they wanted the stronger defensive player on the right to cover for Grealish coming in from that side. And I think maybe the feeling was that Robin Koch would be that player, although I don't necessarily know if that was the case. The other thing is maybe they thought that it would be better for a maybe more mobile defender to cover for Alioski on the left-hand side as well. But I wondered if either of you had any thoughts on that.
I actually thought another factor was just that Koch normally plays on the right, and it might have been that Bielsa, you know, since everyone else was out of position in the defence to where they normally play, at least he could just keep Koch in his normal position rather than swapping them over. So I actually thought it was more that than necessarily other tactical reasons.
I also think that even when he's playing as part of a centre-back pairing, part of the two, Ayling plays a little bit like he's in a back three when he's a centre-back, even when it is a back two. So if you put him on the right of that pairing, then he's going to start doing his overlapping runs and things almost semi-naturally, I think. Whereas on the left, he plays naturally a bit more conservatively because, you know, he's not going to do those overlapping runs on the left side in the same way.
Yeah, I watched an interesting video actually this week looking at Joe Roden. Bizarrely, my friend Nathan Clark, who is a big Spurs commentator, did a long video analysis with a guy called Harry, who is a coach at some academy somewhere, I can't remember. And they were spending a lot of time talking about playing Joe Roden, who's a right-sided centre-back, in a left-sided centre-back position. And obviously, we all know the debates about passing angles when you're playing on the wrong side of your defence to the way that your strong foot is. But he made this really interesting point about the way that certain right-footed centre-backs can actually move the ball out a lot more centrally. Usually, if you're going to try and ping the ball long, you'll move the ball out to the side that your dominant foot is on. So if you take the ball facing down the field, you'll push the ball out to the right on about a 45-degree angle, just so you can get a better strike of the ball. And someone like Joe Roden actually plays the ball out a lot more centrally, and that apparently makes a big difference because it just sort of opens up the field to you a lot more. Your initial first touch can actually make a big difference. Now, I didn't really look at this last night or this morning when I rewatched, but I wondered whether or not there was some element of that as well that Bielsa was thinking of. Maybe he thinks that Ayling is able to progress the ball better on that side, or maybe he feels as though Robin Koch's long passing is better from that side as well. So that probably came into it as well.
I think we've definitely seen that in the past with Berardi playing as the left-sided centre-back. I think he definitely shows elements of that and actually looks better in that position than he does when he plays on the right side of a centre-back pairing.
I just wanted to mention again XG versus post-shot XG, because last week, well, on Monday, we were talking about Leeds making 1.6 XG into 0.5 XG post-shot. So basically that means that the chances that we had would normally result in 1.6 goals if you played the match an infinite number of times. But actually, if you look at the shots after we struck the ball, we would only have scored 0.5 XG. So the chances were reduced by us kicking the ball, basically, which is a reduction of 1.1 XG, which is a big reduction. But actually, what happened this week, this Friday, was it was Villa's turn to do that. So they put up 1.2 XG of chances, but actually after they hit the ball, they only created 0.4 XG. And so it's very much a game of different finishings. And we talked about this last week. You know, this is going to happen in the Premier League. When you have elite players like that, sometimes they're just going to come and put everything away. They're going to take chances and make them even better by the way they hit it. And yesterday we managed to do that much better. In fact, we put up 3.2, quite a bit of XG. Let me get that correct figure for you. And yeah, 3.4 XG, I was correct the first time. So we actually underperformed our XG, which is very least thing to do. But 3.4 XG is a huge amount of XG to be putting up. So it's really nice to see us putting up those sorts of figures. Right, We had some questions about Villa's mid-block, because I think, and I think this is really important context for a lot of what happened last night. I talked a lot in the tactics preview about the way that Villa were going to play a mid-block. And there's a couple of interesting things, I think, to say from that. So we had a couple of questions, so we'll go through those questions first, but then we'll talk about the Pascal Stroik sub on the basis of that. So Richard asks, did Villa's mid-block play to our strengths by giving us time on the ball and space to play through and in behind? Villa's best period of 10 to 15 minutes in the first half came when they seemed to press more aggressively and gain more control in the central midfield. And then Richard said, was it just me or did the Villa wide players just not bother tracking back? Gianni seemed to have the freedom of the left flank. And there's just a couple of things to note. First thing is that I spent a lot of the preview talking about how Villa have been lining up in a 4-4-2 in their mid-block in the last few games with Ross Barkley in the team. And curiously, yesterday they didn't. They went back to a sort of more standard 4-3-3. And in the mid-block, their wingers dropped back a little bit more, so they formed a 4-5-1. And I think this probably informs what we're going to talk about with the Pascal Stroik substitution. But also, I think the Villa's mid-block was just utterly unable to defend against the way that we were playing. So I'm going to hand this one over to you guys first. So Tom, what are your thoughts on the mid-block and the fact that it just seemed completely unable to do anything with respect to stopping Leeds from going forward?
Yeah, I think Richard has hit the nail on the head, really. Like, I think he's described it perfectly well. I think when you actually go through all the games we played under Bielsa, I think this is the defensive style that we probably do best against. Mm-hmm. If you want to beat us, I think you need to really, you know, go hard or go home. You need to park the bus, or you need to be incredibly aggressive and press us high. They're the two styles that we struggle against. I think it is these sort of more wishy-washy mid-block situations, like Bristol City is a good example from in the Championship, that, you know, we make hay in situations like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's an effective strategy to play against us, and I think any team that plays this way against us is going to struggle.
I completely agree, and I think it's something that we talked about in the preview about Villa being in a kind of transitional phase. You know, in terms of last season, they would attack a bit more, or they would, you know, try and go a bit harder and retain more possession. And now they're sort of being a bit more realistic. I remember that's what the Aston Villa chat was saying on the preview, and you could kind of see that yesterday, that they weren't necessarily sure whether they were going to attack and come out at us and press us high, or whether they should sit completely deep and pack 10, 11 men behind the ball. And so I think that, yeah, they ended up in this mid-block that just wasn't really effective. And I think Richard is absolutely right. Like, when they did press us a bit more effectively in the second half of the first half, sort of 20 minutes before half-time, it did work out for them. But I think it was probably a fitness thing, that they just couldn't keep it up for the whole second half.
So I think the reason why teams will play a mid-block is if you're playing against someone who's trying to play it out from the back, what you do is you just say, well, we're not going to be able to win the ball against you in a high press. So what we're going to do is we're just going to sit in a really nice defensive structure and wait for you to come to us, and then we're going to start the press in and around the halfway line. And I think what Leeds did yesterday was they just played so directly. So we saw the ball. We saw lots of switches of play. So the ball from one side to the other, and looking to find one of the wingers. And we also we didn't really mess around with it in our own half that much. And I think what that meant was, is, and the reason why you play that mid-block then, is that you give a bit more coverage for your defence, right? So you've got your central midfielders only sat just in front of your defence, and they do a lot of the defensive work. And I think what we did yesterday was that we bypassed that a lot by speed. We just sort of got the ball forward quickly. We tried to get our wingers isolated one-on-one with their fullback. So Matty Cash had a huge amount of work to do yesterday, because the ball was constantly coming to Harrison, and Harrison was just one-on-one against him. And it's just really, really hard for a one defender to have to go through those actions over and over again. But it was happening a lot on Costa's side as well. And I think as a result of that, it meant that we were getting into situations where we were running directly at their defence. We got in behind their defence, in behind their midfield. And actually, when you put their defenders under that sort of pressure, they collapse a lot. And it was really interesting, I think, the final goal that Bamford scored, none of the defenders seemed to really jump in on him. He seemed to have a huge amount of space, and I think that was because they'd spent the whole game just sort of being run at over and over and over again. And I just think we did a really, really good job of exploiting that. And so I think this is interesting, because I think that, you know, that's a different style of play that we've played, really playing really direct like that. We haven't done that. We didn't do that so much in the championship. And I think a lot of people used to get really frustrated because they'd be like, why are we not playing the ball forward quick enough, etc. But yeah, Villa's mid block, just because they weren't able to ever get into their defensive structure, Leeds were just getting constantly in behind. So that brings us then nicely to Pascal Strauch substitution, which I think has confused a lot of people. I watched the game back and he comes off in 20 minutes and doesn't really do anything wrong. he gives away that yellow card. And a lot of people saying, well, you know, you can't mark Grealish on a yellow card, but he wasn't really marking Grealish either. Like he was covering Ross Barkley largely. And so, yeah, we've got a question from, well, firstly, we'll start off with, I'll question you guys. What do you think the Pascal Strauch substitution was about, Joe?
Just to state the obvious, he was on a yellow and he nearly got a second yellow a minute after that. And that might be something that the ref had said to him, that, you know, you're on your last warning kind of thing. And I think that's happened before in Bielsa's tenure where he's taken a player off who's on a yellow. I think it was Phillips. And I think, yeah, so obviously there's further, deeper tactical reasons, but I think Strauch was very likely to be red carded in the next 70 minutes because he knew that was going to be something Villa would exploit. And players like Grealish, who do win a lot of fouls, would have easily exploited that. And I think that probably would have been it probably would have been a red card for him.
I think you need to look at it like, why do we play Strauch there to start with, right? So we play, and it's the same reason we play Phillips there when we play Phillips there, because number one, oh, well, they're about equal, but number one, he's got a great range of passing. He can play long balls and short balls accurately. Number two, he's got a great physical presence. He's a big lad. He's strong. He can hold off challenges when he's closed down. And I suspect that what Bielsa has looked at is obviously looked at that yellow card and thought, this is a pretty dangerous situation where this player could be sent off. So are those reasons that we've got Strauch in there? Do we actually need that physical presence? Do we need that player who has that great range of passing? And I think he's determined that Click can do the passing acceptably enough, and we don't actually need a player that has that physicality there. So why take the risk of Strauch possibly being sent off? I think that's probably something close to his thought process.
No, I totally agree. I think I was so convinced that Villa were going to try and do something similar, where they would sort of play as a four, almost as a 4-2-3-1, and have Barkley pushing forward and pressing in the two alongside Watkins, because that's what they've been doing in the last few games, and they did that in games against teams who were playing similar systems to us as well, right? They played that way against Liverpool, who play basically the same system that we do. So I suspect that Bielsa probably expected them to come out in that way, have maybe Ross Barkley slightly more advanced, and then have the two, McGinn and Douglas Luiz, slightly deeper in a double pivot. That's not what happened, and I think, like you said, you don't need that. You don't really need that physical presence in a game where actually a lot of the transitions are just taking place in wide areas anyway. Villa are looking to come through Grealish down the left hand side anyway, so you don't even really need some kind of big player who's going to be defensively sound, who's going to be tidying up in those sorts of areas. And so I think that he put up, as you said, Tom, put everything together and thought, I would rather play Click, have a more expansive player on the field as Jamie Shackleton, have the two together, and then you can become a lot more dangerous in that sense. So I think it's a combination, I say, of the tactical aspect of it. Match them up. They were playing with a single pivot deeper, and then McGinn and Barkley together as sort of two eights attacking, and I think he just sort of preferred to have two eights matching with two eights, and then having Click dropping back and doing the build up play when and where was needed. But also because, as we've said, we were playing so much more directly than we usually do, that I don't think he felt that we needed to have, as you said, a really expansive passer in that space. It's more a case of being available for the ball, picking it up, moving it on, and allowing the ball to progress down the wings, because that's where we were eventually aiming to go. So I think that it's a combination of those two things. Moving quickly on then to the second half, we had a question from Just Some Guy 1970 who said, really interesting how we battered them down the wings first half, then when they played wider to counter it in the second, Rodrigo had more of the ball through the middle and really came alive. So guys, what did you, let's start with you, Tom, what did you make of the second half? Because it did feel as though we just sort of dominated them in the second half. And do you think there was a fitness thing, or do you think there was any sort of tactical angle to it?
I must admit, I didn't notice any huge tactical changes at the time, and I haven't had a proper opportunity to watch the full game back. But I think Rodrigo's performance throughout was great, and we seem to have now reached a point where Rodrigo is part of the team. You know, like he will play if he's fit now. He's not going back on the bench, and he's starting to understand the runs. He's starting to understand where people are going to be when he's got the ball, Obviously, if you give a player of that kind of talent space, then he's going to do dangerous things with it. Even when I remember there was one point in the second half, I think, where he sprayed the ball out wide to Harrison, and I thought, oh, he's overhit that pass. But actually, he overhit it by just the right amount, and it ended up being a better pass than something that was a bit more simple. And I think he's good at things like that. He sees moves like two or three steps ahead, and not in the same way that Pablo does, but in a sort of... it's a sort of analogue of what Pablo does in that he sees things a bit further ahead than most players do, I think.
Yeah, it's all about progression for him, isn't it? It's all about taking the ball in one situation and moving it to a more dangerous situation. And we've had a load of effusive questions about a lot of players, which is rightly so. We played really well in the second half in particular. But a lot of this, I do think, comes down to the mid block that Villa are playing, and I do think it really suits someone like Rodrigo, which you didn't see. Like, we had people after the last game being like, should we drop Bamford, should we move Rodrigo somewhere else and stuff like that, and it's really easy to sort of jump on 90 minutes and say this is now indicative of the way that we are. So I would say, you know, whilst a lot of what we did was really great, just try and take it with a pinch of salt. Try and remember some of the frustrations that you had with the Wolves game and apply it. But Rodrigo is really, really gelling in the team. And I think he's a really important player for us because, like Pablo, there's not a lot of really creative players in our team at the minute. And there hasn't been for a few seasons. And, you know, just the ability that he has to play that pass that sets Costa through for the second goal, third goal, you need players like that who can see those angles, can see those chances that no one else can see, and a lot of it is to do with progression. It's about, as I said, taking the ball from one context and moving it to another where actually suddenly we start looking a lot more dangerous.
One thing I would be interested in now, and obviously I don't want it to happen because Bamford's playing brilliantly, but you know, if Bamford got an injury, what would we do with Rodrigo? Would we move him up front, or would we play Tyler Roberts up front? And that'll tell you partly how important Bielsa feels his midfield contribution is to the way that we're going to play like in the future.
I think there's also, Bielsa will like the flexibility that he has in being able to push Rodrigo forward in a situation where you might want two strikers. So it's almost like he's not an out-and-out striker, but he's also not an out-and-out midfielder. So he sort of can play both roles and sort of segue between the two quite comfortably. But I think we have some questions about Rodrigo later on. So maybe actually let's do it now. Let's just ask the Rodrigo question, seeing as we're on the topic. So Montag says, Rodrigo's impact on the team. He probably needs to find his shooting boots, but all-round play is amazing. His link-ups are brilliant, and he rarely loses the ball. Do we think he's our answer in lieu of a 10? So Tom, it sounds like you're saying yeah, pretty much. Joe, what would you say?
I would say yes, as a short answer. This was kind of, when he came into the team, this was kind of where I saw him playing, either there or out on the wing, but still, you know, with the possibility of him playing as a second striker. And I think having that as an option is really important for us, and it's proving really effective. Like, he created the first goal, shot across the keeper, which is the classic thing that you should do in that position. And like you say, he played that amazing through ball to Costa for the third goal. And I think just having another person that you can see getting into the box, making later runs than Bamford, perhaps arriving into the box a bit later, or even arriving to the bo- to the box with the ball at his feet, you know, at the edge of the box, and, you know, him having the ability to get a shot on target from that position. I think he's a fantastic addition, and I agree with Tom. I think if Bamford did get an injury, it would be really interesting to see what happens, because I think he's really growing into that role as a number 10, and he probably does need to find his shooting boots, and it would be nice to see him get a few goals, but his all-round play is really effective at the moment.
Yeah, it's important to say, I think, that over the course of his career, Rodrigo has underperformed his XG, which is, I think, indicative of something. But again, the thing that frustrates me about talking about eights and tens is that I don't think Bielsa does think in those terms, because he'll talk about them in interviews. But I think when he's thinking about setting a team up, he's thinking more in terms of roles. So when you think of Rodrigo, he's playing that Pablo role as well, you know, that idea of who can we bring into this team, who's going to be able to, if you're playing and the system isn't really creating enough chances, you've got this one player who can actually create chances out of nothing. And so you've got just a little bit of a backup in case the system itself isn't coming off as it might do as well. Do you want a final word on Rodrigo, Tom?
Well, I think the other thing that I would say is that it's really good for Pablo as well, I think, to have this other player that, you know, Pablo sometimes feels like he has to bear the weight of the world on his shoulders. And I think, you know, this having Rodrigo as well, it's going to be really nice this season having the ability to use Pablo as and when we need to, rather than feeling like we absolutely have to or we're never going to score a goal again.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Right, let's move on to talk about, we usually go the order here, defence and then attack, but I've reversed it because I think we were so good going forward yesterday and we should really celebrate that. Remarkably, not many questions about Bamford, other than sort of tongue-in-cheek ones, but let's talk about Bamford because, you know, this is really probably the crowning moment of his career to date. You know, it's probably the moment at which you sort of have to say, haters gonna hate, but Bamford's really come out and done what we always said that he was capable of through the course of last season. So who wants to begin by waxing lyrical about Bamford? Joe, do you start us off and tell us about how good Bamford was yesterday?
Well, he was fantastic. We've had a request to get in from Darren Driver, our regular friend on this pod, to reiterate that his chances in the first half weren't actually as easy as everyone is making out, and I do agree with that. I think they were difficult chances, and you know, you like to see them go on target, but to be honest, I don't really care when I look at the other goals that he scored. I'd sort of forgotten all about his missed chances in the first half because, you know, the first one, typical poacher's goal, you know, he's in the right place and that's where strikers should be. But the second and the third goals are just unbelievable. I think he's just one of those players that sees the criticisms that he's getting and, you know, sometimes it can bring him down, but sometimes it can really fuel him. And I think in this game, for whatever reason, he just took those criticisms and just let it fuel him for this game, and just, you know, played against that and played to silence the haters. And I think he did a fantastic job. Like, that second goal was just unbelievable. There's virtually no backlift and it just goes straight in the top bins. You know, it's ridiculous. I think that's easily goal of the month.
He was like watching prime Zlatan Ibrahimovic yesterday.
That's exactly what I was going to say, yeah. Yeah, it was very Zlatan-esque.
Yeah. We had a question from Miguel Ramirez. He says, does Pat Bamford get an England call-up a la Dominic Calvert-Lewin? If not, Mexico will gladly take him. I'm not a great fan of international football, but I guess the question is going to be asked, is Bamford doing enough to deserve a call-up, Tom?
Well, I mean, he's not going to be required to run around like a maniac for 90 minutes versus, you know, Iceland or whoever England go out of the Euros to. So I don't know. I think Bamford's a great player, but does that mean that you put him in the England squad ahead of Calvert-Lewin and Ings? Because I think Calvert-Lewin is actually quite a similar player to Bamford. I think they've got a similar skill set, and Calvert-Lewin's also in red hot form at the moment. So I think, with all, as we've talked about before, with all players in a Bielsa side, they benefit from the system, and you take them out of that system and, you know, it's a completely different prospect. And that's not a criticism of Bamford. Bamford deserves all the praise in the world for integrating into our system and doing such a fantastic job of what he's being asked to do. But he won't be asked to do those things by Southgate. He'll be asked to stand up front and hope for the best. So, I mean, I'm sure it'd be fine, but I don't have any particular desire for him to play for England, other than it's just nice watching Leeds players play for England. But, you know, keep him back at Thorpe Arch, don't get injured.
It's interesting. I mean, far be it from All Stats Aren't We to blow their own trumpet, but we've been talking Bamford up for a couple of seasons now. Josh Hobbs wrote a piece this summer about how the Premier League could suit Pat Bamford, and it seems as though that is all coming good. I looked at his stats actually at the moment, and he's just, it's weird. He's become a different player. Like, usually when you look at Pat Bamford's sort of statistical attributes, he's doing really well on everything other than the striking parts of the game. I mean, he gets in good positions, so his XG is always quite high. But at the moment, he's becoming like the opposite kind of striker. He's not actually doing so much off the ball as he was, and everything he's doing at the moment is becoming a prime poaching striker who can, like, you know, he's sort of becoming Raul Jimenez for us. And it's remarkable to see that. So I think
Mexico will gladly take him.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so you can imagine that, 1-2 of Bamford and Jimenez. But
I must say, I would absolutely love Pat Bamford to get a call up for Mexico. Like, yeah. I'd be fully on board with that.
No, same. That would be great. But yeah, really remarkable that actually, you know, Bamford is playing in a different way, and that different way is suiting him in the Premier League. So long may it continue. Right, it's just a list now. It's a litany of people that everyone wants to wax lyrical about. So let's start off with Jamie Shackleton. Obviously, it's just bizarre. It's bizarre, isn't it? Because Jamie Shackleton could barely get any minutes before this game, and then suddenly he's just sort of slung on after 20 minutes in a game. And he played very well. But I do wonder sometimes what goes through Bielsa's head, you know, the fact that he would rather play Alioski as a central midfielder ahead of Shackleton. And then in this situation, he's just sort of happy to be like, yeah, well, we'll give him 70 minutes. What could possibly go wrong? But yeah, a few questions about Shackleton. So Charlie Hunter says, how good / underrated is Shaq, and would he get better with more time in the pitch? I think he would. And then Simon Tinsley, always one to wind us up about squad depth, says, do we really need an 8 when Shackleton is the best central midfielder in the world? Tom, how did you think Shaq played yesterday?
I thought he was superb. He did lots of those little linking passes, which I think is his speciality when he's in the midfield, like these very short but intelligent passes, and then he moves very quickly to be ready for a 1-2 or whatever. And I think the fact that Bielsa brought him on, as you say, I think we sometimes like to think that we understand what Bielsa's thought process is, and in some ways we do, but then he throws a curveball like this and reminds us that it's actually him that's the genius and not us. I think once you're part of the senior squad, even if you're not playing, Bielsa will be happy to use you, otherwise he would sell you. So I think that's possibly the takeaway from that decision to bring him on. But yeah, I thought Shackleton was great. He was propulsive. He was his movement was very good. I always like watching our movement when we've got a throw-in, because most teams just sort of stand around a bit, but ours looks like a carousel, like a fairground ride or something. Players just running around, and Shackleton's really great at that kind of thing. And also, he's the kind of player, I think, that the more players you have like that on the same wavelength, the better those players look. I sometimes think that Man City hoard players like that, like people like Bernardo Silva, where sometimes what they're doing doesn't seem that obviously great, but the way that they're linking up with players who have a similar thought process, makes what they're doing better and better. And it's that thing we always talk about. Oh, we wish Shackleton would get more minutes, and then he ends up not getting many more minutes, and we can't actually think of situations where he should get more minutes. So it's nice to actually see him get minutes in the Premier League against a decent team and look absolutely the part.
Yeah, I guess my only sort of hesitancy with Shackleton is he just looks so small. And I know that's unfair to sort of lump on a player, because you look at Manchester City, you've mentioned already Bernardo Silva, he's a diminutive player, but so is Phil Foden. I mean, Phil Foden's tiny. We've had Lewis Cook play that sort of role before, and he's been small as well. I think yesterday was a sort of really good example of bringing on a player who... He's a sort of a classic ball carrier, right? We talk about eights all the time, but then if you say that at the moment we've got Click as an eight and Shackleton as an eight, I find them entirely different players in many respects. And again, I wonder whether or not the reason why Shackleton was brought on yesterday was tactical, whether or not Bielsa realised that actually it would be we need to be better in transition than better in defence. This is going to become a game where we're getting a lot of transition. Villa are sitting in a midfield three rather than a two with one in front. And one, that means we can use width, because you've got a sort of narrow band of midfielders, and if you can get in behind their wingers, then you can just run straight at their wing backs, full backs. But also, like, Shaq is just a great ball carrier as well, and I wonder whether or not that came into his head as well. Maybe he just wanted a little bit more, slickness in transition in the central midfield as well. I thought a fantastic game from him. I don't know whether or not, to answer Simon's question, whether or not I would be happy with just the two eights, Click and Shackleton. I would have liked someone of the profile of someone like Rodrigo de Paul, who is both a brilliant ball carrier but also a brilliant defensive player as well. But
I think Shackleton's got quite defined tendencies, hasn't he? Like, you get players who would rather play a 20-yard pass, and Shackleton would rather run 10 yards and play a 10-yard pass. And I think that's a very specific tactical tendency that he naturally has. So he can be very useful to fulfill a certain tactical need because of that, I think, like, as and when it's required.
Speaking of passes, we've had a lot of people talking about the Rafinha pass after he came on. Rich Priestley says, what about that pass from Rafinha? That was Pablo-esque. Not really a question. Was it? That was the question. So he's asking the question, how Pablo-esque was the pass? Clem says, that pass through the middle to the left wing from Rafinha needs some analysis. It was simply sublime. He wasn't on for long, but he showed he's got some real quality. Joe, talk to us about Rafinha and that pass in particular.
Well, firstly, what a pass. Unbelievable. I mean, I'm not sure how much analysis I can really give on it, apart from just saying he completely cut open the whole team, basically. I think there was at least 8 or 9 players in front of him, and they were just all taken out the game, which you just absolutely love to see. I think he's just really showing his quality, even in the small periods that he's played. In the Wolves game, when he came on, he made that great run down the left-hand side and that cut back onto the edge of the box, which really should have been something. In this game, he didn't do too much, but he just shows little individual bits of quality. And I'd quite like to see him come on for a little bit longer if the timing's right and if the tactical setup is right, because I think he can really show what he's made of even further with playing sort of 30 or 40 minutes. I think that'll be fantastic when he eventually does get those minutes.
Yeah, he does seem to be a bit more direct than Helder Costa, in the sense that he loves to come along. He loves to almost run along the edge of the 18-yard box in a way that I don't think Costa does quite so much. But it's going to be exciting seeing a little bit more from Rafinha. Tom, what's your initial thoughts on Rafinha been?
Yeah, he just looks exciting. He keeps the ball very close to his feet when he's dribbling, doesn't he? And he's able to do that because his touch seems to be incredibly good. So, yeah, I wouldn't have any worries about him coming into the team at all if we had an injury or something. He looks very exciting.
Yeah, I did have the feeling as well that you just mentioned, Joe, of wanting to see more of him. I'd love to see him starting for a game, just so you get a real sense of what he's going to look like over 90 minutes. But no doubt that will happen at some point in the future. Right. There was one more question. I thought I included this one actually because it was a bit more negative, so I think it was good to have maybe a bit more of a critical question. Mark Dennett said, I'd be interested to see Costa's stats from the game. I didn't think he did that much. I actually looked into the stats that came out from FB Ref, so the Stats Bomb data. I don't think Costa and Harrison really were that different. I think Harrison was getting the ball a lot more because we were playing that switch ball from either Robin Koch or Stuart Dallas across to Harrison, trying to get him isolated. Harrison sort of carries the ball 273 metres, I guess it is, to Heldekos's 164. So Harrison was getting the ball a little bit more. They made sort of comparative passes. Costa's passing was slightly better, although it wasn't quite so long. So Harrison made 181 metres worth of passes to Costa's 117. But I think the important stat is that they both created a lot of expected assist values. So Harrison created 0.8 XA and Heldekoster created 0.5. Harrison created what StatsBomb calls shot creating actions. So these are just sort of actions that result in shots. So Harrison had 8 of those and Costa had 5 as well. So yeah, I think if you compare the two players against each other, then Harrison probably had the better game yesterday. But I think that Costa was still productive. He was still doing a lot. They both had a lot of touches. They both made a lot of pressing actions. Actually, Heldekoster's pressing was very good, no doubt, because he was on Jack Grealish's side as well. So there was maybe a little bit more work to be done on that side. But either of you got any thoughts on Costa? Because I did see a few people sort of being a bit negative about him, but I thought Costa was fine.
Yeah, I agree. I think people expect him sometimes, I think, to do explosive things all the time, and that's not necessarily always his role in the team. And when people say he's not involved or he didn't do much, I try not to think about things like that. It's more when he did do something, was it worthwhile? Did it contribute to our play? Did it contribute towards us progressing the ball or getting in a situation where we're more likely to score a goal? And I think it did.
Let's move on to the defensive side of things then, because Luke Ayling had another fantastic game yesterday. Both Tom and I have spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about how much we like him as a centre-back in a back three. Yesterday proved that he was good as a centre-back in a back two. Mickey Piquer said, too much to praise from the game yesterday. Ayling, man of the match. And then Neil said, Ayling as a centre-back, discuss. So I think it's only fair that we start with Tom on this one, given that we have spent a lot of time talking about him as a centre-back.
Well, firstly, I think Mickey Piquer has been talking to John a bit too much, because I was having an argument with him earlier on Twitter about Bamford's third goal, which I thought was spectacular, and he was just moaning about the defending. So this is not the Mickey Piquer that I knew 10 years ago, who would have just told me I wasn't being fun enough if I'd have said something like that. But yeah, I thought Ayling played really well. It's a bit disappointing that Darren isn't on this podcast so that we can rub it in his face how well Ayling played as a centre-back, because Darren does not like it. But yeah, I thought he did really well. And I can see that he does have potential weaknesses in a two, but I don't think, apart from that one moment where he dithered over doing his flop and ended up having to clear the ball off the line, I don't think those weaknesses certainly weren't exposed yesterday.
He fell over at one point under no
Oh yeah,
pressure.
He did. Yeah, but again, yeah, like he fell over and Aston Villa's players just stood on the halfway line and didn't even think about trying to close him down. So yeah, I love Ayling. I just think he's my favourite player, and it's 35-year-old men should not have a favourite player, but Luke Ayling is mine.
I agree with you. I think Ayling is, and I was saying this yesterday, I think that, and we disagreed over this, but I do think that the Ayling's trajectory under Bielsa has been remarkable. And I think, you know, he is playing as a legitimately elite fullback at the moment. That's not to mention the fact that he's played a lot of time, spent a lot of time at centre back as well. But I think you could play Ayling in most like top six sides, no problem whatsoever. And I think that's a remarkable thing to say, but I believe it wholeheartedly. Joe, you must have thoughts on Ayling.
Yeah, I think he probably was man of the match for me, either him or Click. I know it might be harsh not to give it to Bamford getting a hat-trick, but I thought those two were brilliant for me. And I agree with you chaps. I think Ayling's one of my favourite players. I think he's developed so much in the past few years, and he's so consistent week in, week out. He just seems to be, I don't know if it's because he's one of the more senior members of the squad, or he's got lots of experience and he's just got a calm head on him. And I think that he can drive the team on. And we saw it a lot last season where if we were having one of those bad games, he can just create something out of nowhere. He'll just go on a run, or he'll take the ball into the middle and, you know, spray out a pass out wide from there. And it's just those little moments that just spur the whole team on. And I think yesterday, obviously going from playing right back to playing left centre back must be quite a lot to adapt to. And I think he did a fantastic job. And I think rightly so, he's the vice captain to Cooper, because I think he really shows that kind of behaviour on the pitch.
Yeah, I think he embodies the spirit of the whole team. Like, he's always trying things. If he makes a mistake, he just gets on with it and tries not to make a mistake next time. He never lets anything get to him. I remember back last season after that Nottingham Forest game where Aylin gave the interview afterwards and he was very down, and people talk about that interview a lot. But what I don't think people do talk about a lot is that Aylin played incredibly in that Forest game. And I think that's partly why he was so down, because his own performance had been outstanding and he was really driving the team on. But we just couldn't get that goal. And I think everything about the way Aylin plays to me embodies the Bielsa spirit on the pitch. And I think he's just a really essential player for us.
I was going to say that one of the things I love about Aylin is that he, and it sounds really unflattering, but he plays within himself. I think no one on our team has an awareness of what their strengths and weaknesses are as much as Aylin. And Aylin does the things that he knows that he can do well, really well, and he will do those things. And it's great seeing that happening. I'm just on FBref now and looking, if you sort the Premier League players, all players in the Premier League by progressive distance for carries, so carrying the ball down the field, Luke Aylin is second after Jack Grealish. So Grealish has 1,361 metres of progressive distance and Luke Aylin is second with 1,190. I think that's just a remarkable stat.
Yeah, considering he's played two of those games as a centre-back as well.
Yeah, exactly. And he's, it's remarkable. And he's obviously a really important part of our team when it comes to progressing the ball down that right-hand side. We would not be doing so well in the Premier League without Luke Aylin. That's an absolute fact. So I need to stop before I start crying. But
Can I just say something quickly about Dallas before we move on from Aylin?
Yeah, sure.
I think
that's
somewhat linked, because we have been at times a bit critical of Dallas playing at left back, and seeing his performance yesterday made me feel like some of it may have been a little bit unfair, just because obviously when he's playing on the right side where he can use his right foot more often, he won't make some of those same mistakes that he makes on the left. And he's a perfectly decent right back for that, for this system. He played really well, so I just wanted to give in a quick all starts that we a bit of praise for Dallas, because he didn't get much of it.
Let's move on then to talk about Mateusz Klich at center defensive midfield. We had a load of questions about this. So Will Clay said, thoughts on Klich dropping a bit deeper once Strauch came off. Chris Kirk says, Klich better than Phillips at CDM, which is maybe a bit of a stretch. But Joe, what's your thoughts on Klich at CDM?
I wouldn't say he was better than Phillips at CDM, firstly. I think Phillips is easily the best in that position in our squad. But I think Klich did fantastically yesterday. I thought, you know, we've kind of already spoken about it, about when we discussed why Strauch came off. But I think Klich's movement and his reading of the game, he always does the stuff that you don't really notice until you decide to watch him. You know, if no one's done this yet, then just watch Klich for 20 minutes or 30 minutes of a game, and just you'll be so surprised about where he pops up and all the movements that he's doing. He just reads the game fantastically, and I think he was perfect for the game yesterday, to be honest, because, you know, we've already spoken about Villa's system and why that suited it, and I think his movements and his range of passing was just perfect for the game yesterday. We didn't need an out and out CDM, and so I wouldn't say that he should replace Phillips in that position, because long term we do need someone of Phillips caliber in that position, and I do prefer Klich a little bit higher up the pitch. But he was brilliant yesterday.
Neil Motby says, to borrow from Stadio, which is another podcast, what if Klich gets sold by Christensen to Utrecht instead of going out on loan? Tom.
I don't like to think about that. I guess we play Adam Forshaw there, right?
We don't have enough eights as it is, do we?
He just interprets that role very differently to any of the other players who we have the option of playing there. I think he makes short passes and then goes off on a run, which it can make us look incredibly dynamic when it works well, because everyone's moving so much, like at the base of that midfield. But I wouldn't want to rely on him there long term, because that movement can be a weakness as well, depending on the sort of the team that we're facing. Whereas someone like Phillips or Strout will sit a bit more and slow the game down when it needs to be slowed down. And I don't think slowing the game down is ever really in Click's mind.
Yeah, again, just to reiterate, it's really, really important to contextualise the way that players play based on the tactical context. And I think yesterday's game, whilst it's wonderful to enjoy dominating a team like that, I think a lot of it will come down to the fact that we were playing against a team who have been setting up in a mid block, and you know, they just did it's tough to go from that to then playing in a different way, right? You can't just play a different style of football against every opposition that you're going to face. And so I think a lot of this comes down to the fact that Villa didn't score the chances that they had, and from that point on, we sort of dominated the game, and that's that. So that's just me being boring. So
I hadn't realised as well that apparently Villa had not gone behind in any game this season before yesterday as well. So that's a new experience for them, like going a goal behind, and they obviously didn't cope with it very well.
Yeah, and just think back to Monday. Monday is a game where we had lots of chances. We could have got, if we'd have gone ahead, that would have been a different game. Mm-hmm. In the end, Wolves went ahead, and that changed the tenor of the game. And that's football. That's how it happens. You try and get the first goal, and then you try and hold that lead. But yeah, one final question on players then. Just a question on Alioski, because I thought that was fair to maybe ask ask a question about him, because he hasn't really played for us in that position for a while. I feel as though Alioski at left back was an experiment that ended in the blip that we had in the Championship, and we've never really gone back to him in that position since then. So James asks, let's have a look at how Alioski coped at left back. So Tom.
I thought he was fine. He didn't make any huge mistakes. He was positionally relatively disciplined. I don't think Trezeguet really did anything of note in the game. I thought he was fine. I'm not sure I'd want him playing there against, you know, Raheem Sterling or someone like that. But in this game, it worked really well.
Yeah, we had a few people asking questions about whether or not this was his best game ever for Leeds, which I wasn't quite sure about. But
yeah, I don't think I'd go that far.
Yeah. Right. One question that we had from last week that I wanted to keep going forward, this was from Cov White, was just about three positives from the game. So I wondered if you guys had three positives. I've got three to give you a chance to think about things first. So my three positives are obviously Pat Bamford proving his haters wrong and having a great game. Another positive was the fact that mid-block isn't the answer to lead, so just a nice clarification that if we come against other teams that play in a mid block this season, we should be okay. And then I've got Shackleton getting a decent chunk of time. Guys, have you got three positives?
Yeah, I'll say the first one is the versatility of the defence. We that's proven that they can all shift around and play out of position and still know the system. For the second one, I'll say it's the new signings showing what they're made of, like Rafinha, Rodrigo. They're showing that they're fantastic signings, and we know that they're going to grow into the team the more that they play. And probably for the third, I find it difficult to disagree with the Shackleton one, because I love Shackleton so much and I love to see him play. And something we didn't mention earlier was that he only was in the squad against Wolves because Cooper got injured in the warm-up. Mm. He wasn't even on the bench when the lineup was named. So I think to go from that to playing so amazingly yesterday really shows that he's got a strong head on him.
Yeah, I think you guys have covered a lot of it off, really. I mean, it's trying to come up with three separate things to what you guys have said would probably be difficult. Ailing at centre back. I think we can definitely close the book on, do we have enough depth at centre back now? If you've got five players who are capable of playing there, that must be enough. It was all positive, wasn't it? So picking out three things from a game like that feels almost, you know, reductive. It's hard to separate anything out, because I thought everyone played really well. Melier as well, I thought, had another great game. Distribution was really good, and he made some important saves. So he's I don't know if he's exceeded my expectations, but he's matched my highest expectations so far, I think.
Yeah, and we was going to have some negatives, but I couldn't really think of any negatives. So instead, I've included a fun question that was sent our way by the inauspiciously named Rate My Sausage, who says, well, Luciano and Lucas have been on Twitter loving last night's results. That's Becchio and Radebe, respectively. Would Lucas and or Luciano do well in the current Super Leeds team?
I think if they're willing to, you know, get up to the fitness standards, I think Luciano Becchio would be a great striker in this team if he, you know, if he's capable of getting that fit. He already runs a lot. He holds the ball up well. Does a lot of the things that Bamford does, really, or in a slightly different way. Bamford's a bit more of a refined player, I think, and Luciano's a bit more blood and guts, but I think he'd do well. And Radebe, definitely. You know, probably more mid-period Radebe than later on when his knees were made of glass, but... you know, the early sort of mid to mid all action Lucas Radebe, I think, would be a great centre back in the system. I think he'd, you know, he'd probably look fulfill a similar role to how to what Cooper does. You know, when he's playing decent enough on the ball, and yeah, I mean, who couldn't be happy with, you know, Lucas Radebe at the back and that brilliant smile?
Yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it, where I just feel like anyone who comes in and takes the system seriously and takes Bielsa seriously is going to look good in this team. So yeah, I would say. Yes, as well. Anything to add, Joe? You're too young to remember Lucas Radebe, surely.
Yeah. Even Becchio. No, I do remember both of them well. And love to see it. Lucas Radebe was one of my favourite players growing up. So just picturing him in this Bielsa side is makes me very, very happy.
Like fan fiction.
Yeah.
Someone will write that. Don't say that, Tom. Right, so looking forwards, we will not be back until Thursday, I think, this week, because the game against Leicester is on Monday night again, so we've got a good long break before we have to start stressing about Leeds United again. On Monday, though, the under-23s are playing Norwich, who I note are top of the Premier League 2, Division 2, so it should be a good game. If you're wanting a fix of football before Monday, they do show that on the Leeds United Periscope channel, so always worth a watch. If you like what we do and you want to get even more of what we do, there's a Patreon channel that we have which has bonus material on it. We put up bonus podcasts, we put up video analyses of games or players. This week, I put up an interview with David Sumpter, who's an interesting guy. He's a professor of applied mathematics at the University of Uppsala. He's just written a book called The Equations That Rule the World, which is really fascinating. If that sounds interesting, head over to the Patreon and check it out. So that's www.patreon.com/allstatsaren'twe. And I actually have a free copy of David's book to give away. So if you sign up in the next few days and drop your name in the relevant post on Patreon, you'll be entered for a draw on that. Three people who have joined the Patreon this week are Ben McKeever, J.N. Ryle, and Beast Tactical. So thank you guys for getting on board. And that brings us to the end of the podcast. And all that remains for me to do is to say thank you, Joe.
Thanks very much.
And thank you, Tom.
Thank you, and thank you, Leeds United.
Yeah, and thank you, Leeds United, very much.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.